From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump visits Pittsburgh today, where the first funerals are being held for the victims of Saturday's shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue. But with the midterms a week from today, the president is trying to change the focus to immigration. He says he will use an executive order to end the right to citizenship for children born in the U.S. to parents who are not citizens of the U.S. And Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says he will introduce legislation that mirrors what the president wants to do. Joining us now is Alan Gomez, who covers immigration for USA Today. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Jeremy.
And birthright citizenship is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, which reads, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So how could President Trump undo that by executive order?
It's a very good question. You just read the 14th Amendment. That was preceded by the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And both of those were affirmed in 1898 by the U.S. Supreme Court, who, to throw in one more quote, wrote, the fundamental principle of citizenship by birth within the dominion was reaffirmed in the most explicit and comprehensive terms. So that's a pretty high legal hurdle to climb when something is in law in the U.S. Constitution and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. But there have been some conservative sort of anti-immigration groups in recent years who have seized on the phrasing that you said, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. They're claiming that somebody who's an undocumented immigrant in this country is still a national of their home country. They're claiming that people who come here through birth tourism, so a Chinese, think of a Chinese national coming to the United States when they're pregnant, giving birth here just so that their child has U.S. citizenship and then returning back to China. They're claiming those kinds of cases do not fall within the 14th Amendment. But as we heard from those from the amendment, and from the Supreme Court, it's a very, very high legal hurdle to climb.
Well, and there are many who will look at this and say we're a week before the midterm elections and this is just a political move that he wants to excite his base, even if he doesn't have any intention of actually doing this or he knows that it will go nowhere in the courts.
Yeah, the timing is incredible because it's not just this. I mean, you look at the fact that he has been hammering on the migrant caravan coming up through Mexico for weeks now, declaring it a national emergency. And just this week, his administration announcing that they're going to send 5,000 active duty military troops down to the U.S. border to stop them. That's on top of already 2,100 National Guardsmen that are down patrolling the border to stop what is now about 3,500 migrants that are trying to make their way up. So he's really seizing upon immigration. I mean, this is a strategy that worked for him, obviously, in 2016. And when they're trying to combat what many are predicting will be this blue wave in this midterm election, he's just going back to the playbook that worked for him and saying, hey, let's just hammer down on immigration over and over and see if that works.
And those migrants that you're talking about, by the way, they're over a month away from the United States by walking. And that's if they go about 30 miles per day.
Exactly. So the idea of having the military on the border right now is probably not necessary, to put it mildly. It's important to know we already have 16,500 Border Patrol agents manning the southwest border. They have been doing this for a long time. Apprehensions are at historic lows along the border. And so the situation right now is relatively calm on the border. But he has been hammering on this for weeks, tweeting about it, threatening to cut off aid to Central America, threatening to tear up the new NAFTA deal with Mexico if they don't stop them. Again, all in an effort to maintain this issue in the headlines and to keep those images of this migrant caravan circulating in the news as often as possible, because again, that's something that worked for him in 16, and he's hoping will work for him this year.
And there are some voters, and I've heard from them on the news in the last few days, who are genuinely concerned about these migrants getting here. President Trump has been saying that there are gang members among them. He had said that there were Middle Easterners, unknown Middle Easterners, among the people in the caravan. Is any of that true at this point? Have we gotten any evidence of that?
We've been asking the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of State ever since Trump started making those claims for any proof. They have not provided any. To your point, I've been tracking a lot of House races around the country that are very far from the border. And yet, in these districts, immigration is an incredibly important topic and one that they're debating nonstop. I was listening to a debate in a House district in Idaho, and the first 11 questions out of the box were about immigration. There was a House race in Minnesota where the candidates were debating the logistics of building a border wall. And I think that shows just how prevalent and how successful President Trump has been at inserting immigration into this election and making it a driving force and making it something that regular Americans are worried about.
That's Alan Gomez, who covers immigration for USA Today. Alan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, with the midterms just a week away, money is still pouring into political coffers. In her Senate race in North Dakota, the Democrat Heidi Heitkamp raised an eye-popping $12.5 million this month after she voted no on Justice Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. But will that money be enough in this very red state? And North Dakota also has a new state law that requires voters to show an ID with a street address, something many Native Americans on reservations don't have, and they helped Heitkamp win last time in 2012. Let's get this week's Senate Tracker with Dave Thompson, radio news director at Prairie Public Broadcasting. Hi, Dave.
Hello. How are you doing, Robin?
I'm good. And so give us some context. Heidi Heitkamp trailing her Republican challenger by several points. He's the Congressman Kevin Cramer. She is used to being an underdog, though, right?
Yes, she is. If you go back 6 years, she was down about 10 points at the same point. And she won that by about 3,000 votes.
Yeah. So she did that in 2012. And this is the same year that Mitt Romney won the whole state by 58%. So don't count her out.
That's correct.
Right. And tell us more about her and what's happened to her standing in the state over time.
She has been a very popular person. She was appointed as tax commissioner and she was elected as attorney general of the state of North Dakota. And she was running a very good race for governor. Before she had to drop out in 2008 when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, probably made the difference in that race. But then she came back in 12 to win the Senate race. But in the same year, Kevin Cramer was elected to the Congress. So they've served in Washington the same time. And Congressman Cramer has been elected, reelected twice.
Yeah. So you've got these two popular politicians. And just talk about this moment when Heidi Heitkamp announced she vote no on Kavanaugh, even though she knew it would hurt her politically in the state of North Dakota. Let's listen.
I'm Heidi Heitkamp, and I thought you should hear exactly why I voted against Judge Kavanaugh. First off, honestly, I don't think he told the truth. And even if he did, he showed himself to be too biased to be impartial. I voted for Neil Gorsuch, so I know there are many other conservative judges who can fill this job without tearing our country apart.
So, Dave, very plain spoken there. I don't think he told the truth. How did people react to that?
For a while there, it became kind of an issue in North Dakota because Justice Kavanaugh had a pretty good approval rating from North Dakota voters. But when it came down to it, I think that whole thing about the Kavanaugh race is kind of died down now. And we're looking at more pocketbook issues in North Dakota. So in terms of affecting her turnout, there are a lot of political advisors I've been talking to, a lot of observers who said that she was in a no-win situation no matter what. If she would have voted for Kavanaugh, she could have hurt her standing with her base in North Dakota. And if she voted against it, there were a lot of people who say the Republicans wouldn't have gone with her anyway.
Right. And this $12.5 million that came in from across the country supporting her because she did that, people don't see that making a big difference?
They don't know if it's going to make a big difference. I know Congressman Cramer would like to point that out, and he did in a debate that was held last Friday. He pointed out the $12.5 million that came in. And he branded it as being from pro-abortion groups. And Senator Heitkamp snapped back and said, shame on you.
Yeah. Well, he's also portrayed her decision to vote no as caving to the coastal elite base. He's a well-known candidate, as you said, North Dakota's only congressman. Let's listen to one of Congressman Cramer's ads. In this one, he's walking among bulldozers and other heavy machinery. You hear it rumbling in the background.
When I went to Washington, one of my biggest goals was to make America a place where businesses could thrive and create good-paying jobs. Opportunity is what makes our country great. That meant cutting taxes and rolling back regulations that were throttling our businesses. And it's paid off. Our national economy is booming. It's a rocket ship. In the Senate.
Well, so he mentions the economic rocket ship. We know the economy is booming right now, but there right. might be a bumpy landing when the tax cuts wear off, which they're already starting to, and the tariffs start to bite. So how is he addressing that with farmers and manufacturers in North Dakota?
In terms of farmers and manufacturers, he's got the same kind of message that this might be a bump in the road, but you have to look at it long term. That if they actually can settle some of these disputes and get better deals for North Dakota farmers, North Dakota manufacturers, it's going to be good in the long run. Well, some farmers agree with that. Some farmers do not, as they see soybeans piling up with no market. And that really is a conundrum for a lot of people.
That's Dave Thompson, radio news director at Prairie Public Broadcasting, talking about the exciting Senate race in North Dakota there. Dave, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And you can see all our Senate trackers at hereandnow.org. 1 week to go.
We had the rare opportunity last week to speak with Alan Greenspan, the man who led the Federal Reserve from 1987 to 2006. He served through booms and recessions. He's now 92. We asked him about the recent volatility in the stock market.
Well, I think it's basically the combination of not what the Fed is doing, which, remember, is short-term interest rates. Mm-hmm. It's what the market itself is doing for the 10-year Treasury note and, say, the 30-year Treasury bond. They've moved up significantly.
We also asked him whether the tax cuts had already had their impact on the economy or whether there was more to come.
The impact has been really quite significant, but it's already completed.
He did say the impact of the tax cuts on the deficit is concerning and could lead to inflation. We also talked with him about the economy more generally. He writes about it in his new book, Capitalism in America, A History, which he co-authored with Adrian Wooldridge. I asked Alan Greenspan if there are two economies in America.
Oh, we have more than two. It's more directly related to the structure of the economy. For example, the so-called Rust Belt is populated largely by industries which are very old. Silicon Valley, for example, is a classic case of the very new. There are very different pockets of economic growth and various degrees of stagnation throughout the country. And it depends, obviously, whether you're in the agrarian areas where soybean prices mean something, mm-hmm. or whether you're on the West Coast where the issue of high-tech stock prices is what everyone talks about. So the one thing about this country is it's very diverse, and it depends where you are.
You write in your book that the growth surge that this country experienced from 1998 to 2004 increasingly looks like a brief interruption of a much longer-term decline rather than the dawn of a new era of tech-driven growth. Why do you say that?
Well, when you look out into the future, we're slowing down our rate of growth in productivity.
Why?
Well, basically because fear. When you deal with fear, it is very difficult to classify. But you can look at the consequences of it, and the consequence is basically a suppressed level of innovation and therefore of capital investment and a disinclination to take risks. In the book, incidentally, I might add, discussing what the long-term outlook is all about, we say that the issue of the aging of the population and its consequences on entitlements is having a significant negative deterioration over the long run. The reason for that is what the data unequivocally show is that entitlements, which are mandated by law, are gradually and inexorably driving out gross domestic savings in the economy, dollar for dollar. And so long as that happens, we have to borrow from abroad, which is our current account deficit, and we have now built up an $8 trillion debt to foreigners. But what this is causing this is largely the demographic issue, the fact that the population is aging. Right now, the official actuaries of the Social Security system say in order to get our Social Security and retirement funds in balance, they'd have to cut benefits by 25% indefinitely into the future.
So do you think they should do that?
First of all, do I think it's going to happen? Well, I don't know, but this is one of the reasons why inflation is the major problem out there. So long as you don't do it, you're going to cause the debt overall, the total government debt, to go rise indefinitely. And that is an unstable situation.
Well, you say inflation is a big problem out there. We've been talking about this for years, that inflation has actually remained very low for the last many years.
That's correct. And in fact, it's been the lowest in American history. And that's all the more reason to be concerned about it. For example, interest rates in 5th century BC Greece were not terribly different from where they are today. So the presumption is that interest rates will rise, if for no other reason, that they're below the long-term human nature determined stability.
What do you say to people who say that you kept interest rates too low during the dot-com boom or right afterwards, and that that helped lead to what we saw back in 2008?
The reason we kept rates low as the unemployment rate fell was the fact that productivity was rising at a very rapid pace. I mean, the dot-com boom was now moving through the economy in the latter part of the 90s. So the reason we didn't move is that we didn't feel that the signals were there. And indeed, the unemployment rate kept falling well below the usual expectation of like 4%. But with productivity rising as rapidly as it did, it changed the numbers. And indeed, the unemployment rate kept falling below 4% with no impact on inflation.
So if those low interest rates were not a cause of the financial crisis, in your view, what was? What do you think led to that in 2008?
Well, I think that what we specifically learned, strangely for the first time in 2008, is there are two conditions that are required for a crisis. One is there a toxic asset like securitized home mortgages, but the critical issue is how those mortgages are financed. And when they are financed by leveraged debt, that's the danger signal.
Do you see anything like that right now?
Nope.
Not in any area?
Well, I don't want to be general. That was a very extraordinary period. I mean, ordinarily, it would have been wholly inappropriate for the Federal Reserve to keep rates down during the period of very low unemployment. But that was what the period was there.
I was having a conversation with somebody in the banking industry recently who said that one of their concerns was that unemployment is so low right now that there are going to be a lot of people who are hired for jobs and paid more than they should be paid, and they're not actually qualified because it's a job seeker's market right now, that the people that want to hire are having a difficult time in many cases hiring people, and that is going to lead to lower productivity and potentially inflation. What do you think about that?
Well, basically, it's not lower productivity, but it's the issue when you get this sort of tight labor market, wage rates begin to rise of necessity. And it's the wage rate rises which affect the cost of production and hence induce corporations to start raising prices basically because their costs are going up. That's where the problem lies. It hasn't really begun yet.
I want to ask you about one more big thing that you talk about in your book, and that is the issue of creative destruction. First of all, explain what that means.
Well, creative destruction is the process by which people do two things. They continuously invest, but the investment is displacing older equipment. But more importantly, it engenders unemployment. And it's the process which, unfortunately, is a necessary condition for growth and standards of living.
You have to let bad things happen in order for the overall picture to be better in the future.
Well, because the very nature of progress economically, as we point out in the book, is the result of creative destruction, which means essentially, for example, when the open hearth furnace came in the steel industry, a whole slew of procedures within the steel industry, so-called Bessemer furnaces, they became obsolete and they were scrapped. But there were also workers associated with those particular furnaces, mm-hmm. so to speak. They lose their jobs. So the labor force is continuously changing, and people lose their jobs, other people gain them. That's the reason the unemployment rate per se is the best measure of finding out how successful the labor markets are.
So let me take that to the next level, which would be, do you think that the government should just let recessions happen? Should they not have stepped in when the financial crisis happened and just allow the chips to fall where they may, and maybe in the long run everybody would be better off?
Well, that's the big argument. I mean, when you get to a state such as the defaulting that was going on in 2008, we put in solutions, which is to give $25 billion to every commercial bank on the grounds that that would enable them to come through the system. And actually, it was a major factor which did solve the problem and stabilize the system.
Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. His new book is called Capitalism in America, A History. You can hear Greenspan talking about the markets and the tax cuts at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
According to the National Retail Federation, retailers are expected to hire as many as 650,000 workers this holiday season. Amazon alone is hiring 100,000 at least $15 an hour. FedEx is adding 55,000 at $14. The Gap is hiring 64,000, and part-timers get a 50% discount. It seems they're doing anything to lure in workers when there aren't a lot available. People have jobs. The unemployment rate is so low. Ali Velshi is an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin.
And give us more of a thumbnail of this season compared to past.
It's probably a good season for people looking for this temporary work, which is a big deal, by the way, because a lot of people get hired in this season. So First of all, we're looking for holiday sales to jump almost 5% from 2017, which is really good. And there are, we have a very low unemployment rate. We are what you call full employment. So there's more money that's going to be spent. There's more of that business up for grabs for some companies, because some companies have gone out of business. It's a good time to get hired. It's also a good time to buy, because a number of these companies are offering better deals for people who are shopping, more, faster shipping, lower prices, things like that. So all in all, if you're a buyer or you are looking for work this holiday season, it's looking pretty good.
Well, we're hearing that $15 an hour that Amazon's offering might be the average, and that's a 32% increase over last year.
It's huge.
Yeah, we just heard Jeremy speaking with Alan Greenspan, former Fed chair, about how this is a job seeker's market. But when you're going for these part-time jobs, can you go in and say, oh yeah, make it 17? I mean,
No. But the fact that Target had trouble hiring people meant that they raised their wages some time ago. Then Walmart followed on that, and then Amazon did. And they all sort of say that it's part of this movement to raise minimum wage. But the fact is, it's all market driven. They are actually having trouble and they're losing workers to each other. So, no, the individual worker can't demand more. But the individual worker is A, likely to get more than they would have a year ago, and B, likely to have options so they can go from one employer to the other and compare offers and possibly do better. So generally speaking, a good thing.
Right. Because, you know, because wages aren't moving in full-time jobs,
yep.
a lot of people will be going for part-time to add to their full-time. And I just want to give a shout-out to UPS, which is giving a the same benefit it gives to its regular workers. A part-time worker at UPS at most locations can get that $25,000 in education assistance,
yes.
even part-timers.
So, look, the part-time gig is a side hustle for a lot of people, right? We talk about being at low unemployment, but the fact is the number of people work two jobs to make the same money. Wages have been stagnant. They've started to increase in the last few years since about 2015, but inflation has also gone up. So all things being equal, the median income earner in America is not earning more than they were before the recession. But we are seeing an uptick in wages at the lower end and for part-time workers. And remember, those people also spend money, so that should be stimulative to the economy.
And we just want to say what we know you would want us to say, Ali Velshi, that even though we have a 50-year unemployment low, and we've got this robust economy, what goes up must come down. Inflation is a robust economy's friend, so it's also a time to save.
That is exactly right. And you can actually get a little bit for your savings now, so that's good.
Good. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
President Trump is headed to Pittsburgh today, where funeral services are being held for a number of the victims of the shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue. There were 11 in total. Joyce Feinberg, age 75, Richard Gottfried was 65 years old, Rose Malinger, 97, Jerry Rabinowitz, 66, Cecil Rosenthal was 59 years old, David Rosenthal, 54, Bernice Simon was 84, Sylvan Simon was 86, Daniel Stein, age 71, Melvin Wax, 88, and Irving Younger was 69. They all spent time in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh, which has been in the news because of this tragedy. Its leafy streets and historic houses, much of the population is Jewish. But it's also Mr. Rogers' actual neighborhood. It's where Fred Rogers lived when he was making his show, a show we wish we had to help us through a week like this. Roberta Schomburg is executive director with the Fred Rogers Center. She's with us from Latrobe, Pennsylvania, just outside Pittsburgh. That's where Rogers was born. He moved to Squirrel Hill when he got married. Roberta, thank you for joining us. And you knew Fred Rogers. What can you tell us, first of all, about his time in Squirrel Hill?
Well, this is a really sad day in the neighborhood. I know that Fred enjoyed the community, the diversity in the community of Squirrel Hill, and he loved walking down the streets and noticing the trees and the various temples and synagogues and churches that all made him feel at home, the bakeries, the delicatessens, and he often commented that he could hear Yiddish and Hebrew and a dozen other languages spoken as he walked down the street of that community.
He actually learned Hebrew, didn't he?
He did, yes.
Wow. Do you think that part of the Mr. Rogers neighborhood that we saw on television was based on Squirrel Hill?
The Mr. Rogers neighborhood, I think, certainly had some of the philosophy of the Squirrel Hill neighborhood. You know, I think that it was a fantasy neighborhood, the neighborhood of make-believe. Mm-hmm. But I think what came through was the way people cared for one another, which certainly, I think, was reflected to him through the Squirrel Hill community and probably also the Latrobe community where he grew up.
During the time he made his show, there were not mass shootings in the news the way there are today, but there was certainly violence. We're reminded of 1968 after Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. That word assassination came up in a special that Mr. Rogers did. And the puppet Daniel Tiger had this question for Lady Aberlin.
What does assassination mean? Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
That's what happened, you know. That man killed that other man.
I know, and a lot of people are talking about it right now.
Too many people are talking about it.
A lot of people are sad and scared about it, you know.
I'd rather talk about it some other day.
Whenever you like.
That sound, courtesy of the Fred Rogers Company. Lady Aberlin goes on to change the subject to a picnic, but Daniel Tiger says he doesn't feel like a picnic. She says, that's okay. What do you think Fred Rogers taught kids about how to handle difficult emotions like the ones that I'm sure many are experiencing right now after what we just saw in Pittsburgh?
Well, I think one of the things that he taught us all is that it's all right to have these feelings, to feel sad and to feel angry and to be afraid. And there's nothing wrong with those feelings, but that it does help if we can talk to someone. So for children, the message was that grown-ups are there to listen. And I think the message to grown-ups were it's listening to the children is very important, and letting them tell us what they understand about it and helping them to learn to make sense of what they see. And one of the things that Fred often said was that his mother always told him in times of crisis to look for the helpers. Mm-hmm. And I think certainly in the Pittsburgh area, what we saw were all the helpers, the emergency response team, the police officers, the firefighters, the ambulances, the doctors, the nurses, right. Everyone has surrounded this community with caring. And that's one of the things I think we can help children recognize and identify with, so that they identify with the helpers and not those who cause destruction.
I've seen that line a lot on Twitter in the last couple of days. Look for the helpers.
Yes.
As part of that same special that aired in 1968, Fred Rogers actually addressed parents directly about violence. Let's listen.
I've been terribly concerned about the graphic display of violence which the mass media has been showing recently. And I plead for your protection and support of your young children. There is just so much that a very young child can take without it being overwhelming.
What do you think Fred Rogers would be telling parents right now to do with their kids?
Well, I think one of the things that probably is helpful is for all of us to find time and space to be together away from media where we can talk and share our comforting of each other. So I think that's an important thing. But I also think one of the messages that Fred Rogers gave was that we have to figure out how to make goodness attractive. And I think that dwelling on the violence, of course, undermines that message. So looking for the helpers helps us see the good that is still around us. Fred Rogers said that we have one life to live on this earth, and we can spend that time encouraging people to demean this life and be hateful, or we can spend that time creating encouragement and spaces where children and others can use this life in very meaningful and creative ways.
Roberta Schomburg, what do you think Fred Rogers, and you knew Fred Rogers before he died in 2003, what do you think that he would think of what happened in his neighborhood over the weekend?
Well, I think he would be horrified by what happened, and he would be concerned about the children. He would be concerned that they may be afraid and they may be angry and they may see these reactions in the adults. And so it's important for us to help children learn that the feelings are normal and manageable, but find ways to talk about it and find ways to express anger and find ways to express sadness in ways that are not harmful to other people. And, you know, I think that the comforting of neighborhoods, I think he would also say we need to turn to our neighbors, and neighbor in the greatest sense of the world. Everyone who lives on this planet is a neighbor, and reach out and provide support to our neighbors, to people of all backgrounds, of all faiths, of all races, so that we can live together on this earth in very productive ways.
Well, what's this been like for you, living right there outside of Pittsburgh?
Well, it's been very hard. I've been meeting and talking with some of the teachers in early childhood programs. My own background is child development and early childhood. And so I've been talking with some of the teachers and the directors of programs, some of the Jewish preschool mm-hmm. programs about what we can do. We're actually going to be having a conference next week to talk about ways to support children for families and early childhood providers in the Pittsburgh area.
That is Roberta Schomburg, who is executive director at the Fred Rogers Center outside Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Hillary Clinton raised some eyebrows recently when she told Recode's Kara Swisher during Kara's podcast recording at New York's 92nd Street Y that, well, what exactly did she say? Because soon a banner appeared on CNN reading Hillary Clinton running for president in 2020. Let's get our weekly guide to the world of tech and more, Recode. And today it is with Recode's Kara Swisher. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, but so a lot of reaction to what people thought.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, people thought was Hillary Clinton saying, I want to run for president. Your first thoughts?
She was not saying she was running for president. She was saying she would like to be president. That's like a different thing. That's what I took away from when I was sitting next to her. So.
Right, and you were the one asking her questions. You tweeted that out,
Yeah. But
that didn't stop people from, you know, speculating, and there was both some hope, but also a lot of outrage. Let's listen to the full context of what Secretary Clinton told you last week at the 92nd Street Y. It's the taping of the Recode Decode podcast.
We're going to talk about 2020 in a minute. Do you want to run again?
No.
Wait.
No.
That was a pause.
Well, I'd like to be president.
Okay.
I think, hopefully, when we have a Democrat in the Oval Office in January of 2021, there's going to be so much work to be done. I mean, we have confused everybody in the world, including ourselves. And we have confused our friends and our enemies.
Right.
They have no idea what the United States stands for, what we're likely to do, what we think is important. So the work would be work that I feel very well prepared for, having been in the Senate for 8 years, having been a diplomat in the State Department. And it's just going to be a lot of heavy lifting.
So are you going to be doing any of that lifting? Do you feel like?
Oh, I have no idea, Kara, but I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to even think about it till we get through this November 6th election about what's going to happen after that. But I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure we have a Democrat in the White House come January of 2020.
Okay, so Kara, she was talking about how America's policies and have confused a lot of people around the world, but she did confuse some people there by saying,
a little bit.
Yeah, she's not going to be running. I'd like to be president. What did you take from that?
I think she could have been more explicit. Let's be clear. She could have said, I am absolutely not running for president, but I'd like to help whatever candidate is to do this, or I would be part of an I'd be happy to be part of an administration that was a Democratic administration in 2021. So I think she could have been more explicit. And so in a lot of ways, she was sort of having her cake and eat it too, but she has no intention of running from the people I talk to and the people close to her. And she herself, I think, has sort of left that off the table.
Well, we could hear a lot of disappointment in the audience that come to hear her speak, but also other Democrats voicing concern that she was injecting herself into politics just a week before the midterms, when the Republicans, and specifically President Trump, use her as someone to gin up their base and get people to vote for Republicans. You did try to shift her attention to other potential Democratic candidates in 2020.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Warren, Michael Bloomberg. What'd she say?
She was being very diplomatic about all of them. I know she has more thoughts on them, both positive and negative, but she tried to stress the positive aspects of each of them and what kind of candidates they'd be, and sort of was assessing them on that. She didn't do the negative assessments. But I think what she was trying to say is there's plenty of people in the slate of candidates, and all of them would be different, essentially. What was really interesting about it to me is that what happens whenever she says anything, she obviously is Trump's favorite person to attack, you know, among his base. At the same time, other people who have lost elections, and she didn't quite lose this one, she didn't lose the popular vote at least, which must be just grating upon her, you know, always, I would think, for the rest of her life.
She had 3 million more votes than President Trump.
Yes, yes. So other candidates who lost, John McCain, who's of course passed, John Kerry, Mitt Romney, they all get to speak up now. They get to speak up quite loudly. And whenever she does, Democrats and others decry her for doing so. I find that really unusual. And I think she should be able to talk up. I think she should be able to say things she wants, and that everything she says shouldn't be parsed quite so much.
Well, so we're still left with her saying, you asked if she would do the heavy lifting. You meant, I think, you know, well, will you run for president? I think she heard it as, will I help other candidates? She said she wasn't running, but she'd like to be president. And you interpreted that as,
right,
who wouldn't have wanted to put that much work in and be a politician? Who wouldn't have wanted to be president? But it's still, there's sort of a cloud over what she meant. But you did ask her specifically about Russian interference in the midterms. What did she say?
Well, I'd done that because right after the election, I did an interview with her where she was sort of painting the picture of exactly what the Mueller investigation found. And at the time, people had made fun of her for doing that and calling her paranoid. And so I wanted to point out that she was entirely right about what she had said about the impact of the Russians. Unfortunately, I think we'll never know what the true impact is, except that they were there and it had some impact. And so we were discussing essentially that she was right about what had happened and what we need to do going forward. And she definitely criticized the social media companies for their role in that problem and wondered whether they were prepared for elections going forward.
That's Recode's Kara Swisher on her conversation with Hillary Clinton. We'll link you to her podcast, Recode Decode, at herenow.org. But don't think you're hearing Hillary Clinton say she's running, according to Kara. Kara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm glad we cleared that up, sort of. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.